Thank you. I've given this a theoretical twist. I'm an experimenter, and I hope I survive at the ITP. I'm going to talk about searching for dark matter axions. There'll be some focus on the experiment I'm working on, but I'm trying to give a broader picture. And this little guy's basically doing what I'm doing. He's looking up in the sky, he's looking at our halo, and he's trying to put his finger on axions. That was supposed to be cute. Let me give you the really big, this is a tough crowd. Let me give you a really big picture. Where are axions in the scheme of things in the really big picture? The really big picture is three important subfields, particle physics, nuclear physics, and astrophysics, and among other things that they do, one of the things they do is look into QCD. This is, of course, how quarks and gluons interact. And one of the things that came out of this study in the big picture is the vacuum, or what we think of the vacuum as a very, very complicated place, not even in a quantum mechanical sense, but even in a classical sense. The QCD vacuum is extraordinarily complicated. So QCD is interesting to me because it asks the question, what is nothing? Okay? On the other hand, the same subfields of physics go in the direction of cosmology, which is really how the universe evolved from its very beginnings. And one of the pieces of this is there seems to be something called cold dark matter, which is most of the matter, and that asks the question, what is everything? So this is axions, what is nothing, what is everything, and that's really what axions are about. So it covers the bases, to put it mildly. Since I'm at the ITP, I'm going to start with QCD and the nature of the vacuum. This is more theoretical than my taste. If you were to pick up Jackson's book on electrodynamics, classical electrodynamics, and looked up what is the vacuum in classical electrodynamics, this is it. It's a region of space where the B field is zero and the electric E field is zero. If Jackson were to write a book on classical chromodynamics, and you looked up in the chapter, what's the vacuum? Well, there'd be a similar vacuum. There'd be a vacuum where the equivalent of the color B field and the color E field is zero. That's certainly there in his vacuum. There'd also be a vacuum where there are regions of space-time where the strong E fields and the strong B fields are non-zero. And these were dubbed instantons, of course. And they're very interesting classical objects. They're regions of non-zero E, color E, non-zero color B. It turns out that all these various vacua, and these are all legitimate vacua, can be characterized by a topological index. There aren't an uncountably infinite number of these vacua. Topologically, it's just like winding a string around donuts. There's only n ways you can do it. So these instantons actually generate a topological index, and the topological index has something to do with the field. The take-home lesson is, in classical electrodynamics, there's one distinct vacuum, and in classical chromodynamics, there's an integer number of distinct vacua, and this makes all the difference. This is actually what we think the vacuum looks like. Please. You bet. And you would guess not, okay? But the action is a Euclidean action. Let me just say that. And that makes all the difference in this, okay? So that's the short answer. They're all degenerate vacua is the short. Maybe that's even a better answer. I'll leave it at that. They're all degenerate. Instantons are funny objects. They're not defined in the usual space-time that you think of. They're defined in Euclidean space-time, and that's a problem. In thinking about them, anyway, for me. People model vacuum. They run lattice calculations. This is a slice of space-time. This is sort of a Fermi by a Fermi slice of space-time. And you see these structures, and this is basically the strength of the gluon field in the vacuum, classically. It's a very complicated place. This is, of course, the topological index, and it's negative in some regions, minus in other regions. So people have actually taken this complicated space-time to heart, and you could actually make pictures of it, thanks to lattice techniques. Because you have this degenerate vacua, all these vacua are degenerate, they're, and these instantons, when they wink in and wink out, they wink in and out because they're only there for an instant, I guess, you have tunneling between the vacuum states. So you've seen this problem before. If you have tunneling between degenerate states, the physical vacuum is a superposition. This is the superposition. Here's the sum. This N identifies N of the vacuum configuration, this winding number, with a weighting factor. So it looks a lot like block waves. And this is actually given a name. This theta is a number, but this is called the theta vacuum of QCD. This isn't anything beyond the standard model, by the way. This is in the particle data book, by the way. So this doesn't require any gymnastics. This is just the way it is if you buy QCD. So you might ask the question, is this theta, which is a number modulo 2 pi, observable? And you answer that by calculating something. So this is how you calculate something. This is how MIT determines my salary. Okay? They use this formula. This is my salary operator. And my salary operator depends on all the fields in the theory that they decide to put in to figure out my salary. The prescription of this technique is you take my salary, you weight it in such a way, and you integrate over all possible paths. That's the way you figure out someone's salary. And I'm not showing the denominator, the normalization here, to keep it simple. The complicated vacuum comes here. Because the vacuum is complicated, you have to do an additional sum. This sum, or piece of the sum, gets moved here. That's it. What this is this vacuum is now equivalent to adding a new potential, and it's non-perturbative. So it comes, this new potential, which has E dot B in it, these are color E, color B, times theta, this number, comes from just the topology of QCD. It comes from having the sum here. Just like in electrodynamics, of course, E dot B is parity violating, etc. And apparently theta is an observable. There's a potential that's weighted with theta. It's an observable. And now you have to ask, what's its value? The standard model parameter. What's its value? Before I get to what's its value, I want to talk about spinning balls. Okay? And in particular, what would an electric dipole moment of a spinning ball imply? Okay? People have looked at this. This is a grand problem. What's the relation between spinning balls and CP violation? Everybody knows that there are several discrete mirrors. There are several discrete symmetries, time reversal, changing sign of charge, space inversion. Let's look at a spinning ball. Okay, and quantum mechanically, it's a spinning ball with a non-degenerate ground state, but that's what I mean by a spinning ball. The ball has a spin, and you pose that there's an electric dipole moment parallel to the spin. You apply the T-mirror, the spin flips, the dipole moment, electric dipole moment, doesn't flip. Apparently, it's T-violating. If you believe that CPT is near and dear, if you saw an electric dipole moment to a spinning ball, you'd have a CP-violating effect. You could use a spinning ball if you were quite sure that it didn't have a degenerate ground state. It's hard to do that with a bowling ball. So what you use are elementary particles where it's not where it's clear that there's no unknown degeneracy there. If the spinning ball is an electron, people have done measurements. The electric dipole moment is vanishingly small. It's less than something of order. Oh, here it is, 10 to the minus 26 e centimeter. That's not surprising because QED doesn't have this complicated vacuum, shouldn't have any of this CP violating effect, etc., etc. If the spinning ball is a neutron, the measurements of the electric dipole moment give a magnitude for that of less than 10 to the minus 25 e centimeters now. This is actually quite surprising. If you were just naively to compute the electric dipole moment of the neutron, you'd say, well, I've got to get charge from E, and I have to get a size from the neutron mass, and maybe we know there are quarks, so I'll put in some factors which account for the quark structure, mass of quark, mass of neutron, and you get something of order 10 to the minus 16 E centimeter. And you stare at the 10 to the minus 16 and the 10 to the minus 25, and you've got yourself a problem of many orders of magnitude. You could argue that maybe this is too naive. On the other hand, you can do lots of work, and you get an answer which isn't so different. You still have this huge discrepancy. This has been given a name. It's called the strong CP problem. And the statement of it is, why is this number theta so close to zero when you expect it to be order one? Or phrasing it another way, why is QCD CP violation so small? So now the question is, what's axions have to do with this? And approaching this, I would go with Sakivi's idea, which is to think about playing pool. Okay? So actually, Mel Schachat and Sakivi were playing pool, by the way, when Sakivi was explaining this. And Schachat won. But anyway, why axions, Sakivi's pool table? Sakivi says, gee, I like to play pool. And I like to play pool with a pool table that's flat. I don't like it to be tilted. That spoils the game. Well, how flat does he like it? He likes it to be flat. In other words, he likes the angle, the mismatch, to be less than a part in 10 to the 9. And there's a way that you can get that flatness. It's called fine-tuning. You can sit and just screw these little legs up and down, and you get it flat. Unfortunately, the buildings settle. Things evolve, you might want to move the thing to another room. You can see that the fine-tuning only works in a very fine and specific case. Sakivi had the idea that I will make a dynamic pool table in the following way. I will take the pool table and pivot it. There's a pivot. The pool table can now pivot. I secure a weight on a bob to that pivot and let it go. The table now rocks. Okay? And here's what happened. He said, I took my original pool table, added a potential to the pool table. What happened to the pool table? The pool table settled to a stationary point where the average angle is zero. So by adding dynamics to the system settled to a stationary point where the average angle is zero. What's that have to do with axions? Here's what it has to do with axions, and this idea, I think, originated with Petchenko-Quinn and was later firmed up, very short later, firmed up by Weinberg, Wilczek, etc. What they did is the following. They said, I will suppose that our standard model has a new piece to it. This is now beyond standard model. There's a new U1 chiral symmetry, which Petchenko-Quinn modestly called the Petchenko-Quinn symmetry. And you assume that this symmetry is spontaneously broken. And in doing that, you get a Goldstone boson. The Goldstone boson adds a potential, and here it is. Here's the Goldstone boson. Here's E color dot B color. And there's something new here I wanted to point out. Almost all the theory, if you will, the uncertainty in this, comes in this scale where the symmetry is broken, the symmetry-breaking scale. There's a new scale here, and it's here. And there's other minor things, but basically all the theory comes in here. So we continue. Where does this thing settle to? The thing settles to a point where CP is conserved. By adding this potential, the thing settles to a point where CP is conserved. And the Goldstone boson now acquires a vacuum expectation value. The oscillations about that expectation value is a new particle, and we call it the axion. So I'm following sort of a Higgs-like presentation here. So basically, look what happened. There's a chiral symmetry. It's spontaneously broken. Goldstone boson comes in to this new potential. The thing settles to where CP is conserved, and excitations about the expectation value of the Goldstone field is a new particle called the axion. And to my taste, anyway, after 20 years, this mechanism is the best solution to the strong CP problem. I just don't know of a better one, and I'm looking all the time. let me tell you the properties of the axion. It's got to be a pseudoscalar. It was invented to solve the strong CP problem. It's a pseudoscalar. The mass is unspecified. We don't know the mass. We do know the mass goes inversely with the symmetry breaking scale, but the theory doesn't specify the mass. It's just not known. The axion has lots of couplings. Essentially, anything a neutral pion can do, an axion can do. The masses are very different, but so be it. This coupling is going to be basically what modern experiments focus on. It's the axion, it's a spontaneous decay of axions into two photons. This is the effective coupling for that, and there's an effective coupling constant, Ga gamma gamma. And Ga gamma gamma, so here's axion into two photons now, E dot B. The coupling constant goes inversely to the symmetry breaking scale and proportional to the mass. That it goes proportional to the mass tells you that if the mass is low enough, this is a very weak process. The coupling constant just becomes extraordinarily weak. And one of the interesting things is it's the case that we have actually a rough idea of what these couplings are. They're related to the electromagnetic and the color anomaly. Okay? And we actually have an idea of what it is, which is kind of nice. Given a mass, we know what the couplings are. Let me launch off into the dark matter aspects of axions. Okay, so hold the thought on QCD. This should be very familiar because Santa Barbara has been beating on dark matter for quite a while. This is the picture that seems to be emerging of what our universe is made out of in the biggest picture you can imagine. This is stuff in units of closure density. Okay. The total seems to be close to one of all stuff, be it quintessence plus matter, be it lambda plus matter. It's all close to one. The dark energy component of that is maybe 0.6, maybe 0.7. The matter component is maybe 0.3. That's the cocktail that it seems to make people happiest, that seems closest to the data. This is the picture of where it came from. One of the most confident things that we can do is look at clusters of galaxies. Most of the mass is locked up in clusters of galaxies. You can look at clusters of galaxies, and from how things move, you can infer how much dark matter there is. And you can just add that up. It's a very safe thing to do because it gives you a lower bound to how much mass is hidden from you, how much is dark matter. When you do that, you get this bound here. And this is the amount of matter on this axis. And the Sloan Sky Survey has had some interesting things to say about this too. But basically, the 0.3 or so comes from clusters, just adding up the dark matter in clusters, fairly safe. As you know here as well, the cosmic microwave background is pointing towards a line here, which is basically this plus this is one. That level up here, it measures the sum. As everybody knows as well, these supernova, deep redshift supernova, give us the orthogonal line. They give us this direction. And the amazing thing is, or not, depending on how you feel about these things, is they all overlap here, roughly. And we can quibble about where the overlap region is. But this is our big picture, and this is really the evidence of why we think that there's a fairly substantial chunk of uniformly distributed energy, and about 0.3 or so of matter spread over the universe. You might ask now, what is that matter made out of? And this essentially levers, you could argue on other things, but to me the strongest argument is really the primordial nucleosynthesis, that we really have an understanding of what happened since elements were made in the Big Bang, light elements were made. Recently, there have been what I call, people argue with me, but I call them improved deuterium abundance measurements. People have measured deuterium in a rather narrow band, the abundance, looking at deep, fairly deep redshift deuterium abundance, that translates into a rather narrow, if you go through all the machinery of primordial nucleosynthesis, a rather narrow band of allowed baryon density. Okay. In fact, you can have about 5% of that number one in baryons from these kind of arguments. But we've seen that we really have something closer to 0.3 or 0.4 from just adding up clusters. There's a gap between what nucleosynthesis wants us to have, which is about 5%, and we can quibble, is it 5, is it 1, or the 30-40% matter density coming from more classic, more large-scale, I should say, measurement of cosmological parameters. This is prima facie evidence for non-baryonic dark matter. Can't be baryons unless it's hidden in black holes. There are ways to evade this, and they're somewhat exotic. Not impossible, but somewhat exotic. What is the nature of this dark matter? So let's just take it that there is this dark matter. If you want to argue about it, you can probably argue about it. There are facts you could argue. But as you know, there's two broad categories of dark matter. There's hot dark matter, and it's fast moving at a certain epoch, and neutrinos are the poster boy of hot dark matter. There's cold dark matter. It's slow moving at a certain epoch, and WIMPs are, as Harry gave a colloquium, I think, on this, but we all know about WIMPs. Axions are another one. So what is it? Is it hot? Is it cold? That's probably the first cut that you give, and there's ways to attack this, and they all sort of are predicated on structure that we see in the universe. And the one that gets me fairly excited is look at when galaxies form. We'll look back in time, look at QSOs, find out where in redshift they were formed. This is the QSO formation rate versus redshift. And you find that QSOs, in other words, galaxies, the host galaxies, were formed at sort of redshifts 2, 3, and a hair. Okay? But when we look around, we see that the superclusters that enfold these galaxies are just forming now. So the hierarchy of structure we see is very clear. You make small things, the small things cluster into larger things. Okay? It turns out that hot dark matter generates structure in the opposite sense. You take big things and you break them up into smaller things. This is actually fairly strong evidence that understanding the observed structure in our universe requires a substantial amount of cold dark matter. Okay? And there are other things besides the galaxy formation ring. What about our own galaxy? What about spirals like our own galaxy? Spirals like our own galaxy. Well, there's actually a poster boy spiral galaxy. It's NGC 3198. This is the poster boy spiral galaxy. We see it sort of at a weird angle, but there it is. If you look at velocities in this thing as you go out from the center, okay, this is what you actually measure. This is the velocity, the circular velocity as you go out from the center, and this is distance from the center. This is what you would expect to see if the velocities obeyed these Keplerian orbits with this as the enclosed mass, with the bright stuff as the enclosed mass, that it levels off, tells you there's an abundance of matter that you don't see in this object. And it's fairly direct. In fact, for our own Earth, there's something like half a proton mass of dark matter per cc near us. That's sort of in our own galaxy what it translates to, be it WIMPs or be it axions. Let me briefly talk about now axions as cold dark matter. There's axions in this room. These low-mass axions are good cold dark matter candidates. They're actually produced cold in the early universe. They produce in a phase transition. They never equilibrate. They're never in thermal equilibrium with any other particle species. They don't thermalize, and the couplings go as the mass. So very light axions are cold, even though they're light. On the other hand, if the mass is too low, the axion energy density becomes too big. You make too many of them, and you severely overclose the universe. The axions cluster into galaxies with other matter. In fact, they seed, probably, galaxies and other matter. And gravitational kicks will start with a cold spectrum and eventually yield a Maxwellian spectrum of some kind. In other words, as the stuff infalls, they're subject to random gravitational kicks. What started cold picks up velocity. So this is sort of what you see. Recent stuff is narrow. This is the energy spectrum of axions here. Recent stuff is narrow, and stuff that's hung around our galaxy for a while picks up a quasi-Maxwellian line. And it takes a certain amount of time for the stuff to thermalize. Okay. I should mention this peak in our galaxy. The peculiar velocities of stuff in our galaxy is kind of 10 to the minus 3 C. So this energy width is sort of 10 to the minus 6. That's roughly where that comes from. Let me tell you the state of axion searches circa 1995. This is a cute little sketch. This is the axion mast here. This is an MEV, and this is a micro-EV, so it covers a huge dynamic range of axion mass. If the axion were heavy, it would couple strongly. It would be a new pion of some kind. It wasn't seen. As it gets lighter, the couplings get weaker, but you would still have an effect on basically the evolution of astrophysical objects. You speed the evolution. You have an efficient way to get energy out of objects, be it red giants, etc. A supernova 1987A was the perfect example of that, and we'll talk about that a little bit. And again, if the axion were too light, much lighter than a micro-EV, they'd overclose the universe. There's a window of roughly a milli-EV, sorry, to a micro-EV, where you can have axions, and somewhere in here they'd have something to say about dark matter. That's why it's a very interesting window. So there's the window, 10 to the minus 6 to 10 to the minus 3 EV. And I remember I gave a colloquium like this at Harvard, actually, and some theorist stood up and said, look, it's impossible. There's no scale of a milli-EV, so it would be impossible to have these. And the next day in the New York Times, milli-EV neutrinos, you know, evidence for. But so that felt kind of interesting to see that. to put it mildly, let me tell you about the accelerator search here. This was done at SLAC. It's sort of the poster boy accelerator search. The idea of this is you take 20 GeV electrons, and you smash them into a beam dump. Okay? You produce axions in some Primakov-type production, axion. Basically gets tickled by nucleons or fields in the beam dump, and two gammas come out. And, you produce the axion via Primakov production. The axion has a decay region, and you can perhaps detect the electromagnetic parts of the decay. This is also interesting because Bjarne Kane was deeply involved in this, so you don't often see a bona fide positive contribution from a theorist in this, but this is an encounter example. And this is what they saw, or not saw. This is the axion mass here, and this is the lifetime into the two-photon mode. This is what you'd expect with a standard Petchy-Quinn axion, okay? And this is what they excluded in terms of lifetime. So everything above this was excluded, and everything below that was still allowed. What this experiment did is divorced that symmetry breaking scale, that FPQ, from the weak scale. Before then, people really wanted to tie these two together, and it's something that people do over years and years. They want to tie things to the weak scale. When Guth did his inflation model, the inflaton was tied to the weak scale, and he dearly didn't want to give that up. Eventually he had to. But that's what these experiments did. They divorced the symmetry breaking scale from the weak scale, and the symmetry breaking scale really has to be quite large to give you a small mass axion. There, as the axion gets lighter in mass, you have astrophysical arguments, and the strongest one comes from supernova 1987A, and this was a a supernova in a nearby galaxy in the LMC, a neighbor. It's a core collapse star produced, a supernova, produced incredible amounts of energy, as you know, released almost completely as neutrinos. So that's the zen of these supernova. The neutrinos are actually trapped and have to diffuse out. The matter is very, very dense. And the diffusion time is something like 10 seconds or so. Okay. Kamiokande, as you know, and IMB, these were experiments, terrestrial experiments, and together they recorded about 19 neutrinos from the supernova burst. So it was a very important event in 1987. What would an axion do? If an axion were of the right mass in the supernova, it would efficiently transport energy out of the star and foreshorten the burst. No longer do you have to wait for these neutrinos to diffuse out. This axion would just free stream out and shorten the burst. On the other hand, if the axion were too light, it wouldn't couple strongly, you wouldn't make them. If it were too heavy, well, they'd diffuse, and you'd run into the opposite argument. So this is just a picture of that. This is the axion mass here on a logarithmic scale. And this is basically the contribution of the axion to the stellar luminosity. And you can see that if the axion, this is from a Turner paper, if the axion were much lighter than 10 to the minus 3, he argued, and there's fuzz on these things, he argued that you wouldn't know an axion was there, wouldn't contribute enough. If it were bigger than 10 to the minus 3, but not too blazingly big, you could have detected it as foreshortening of the burst. These arguments are what leave you this window of 10 to the minus 6 to 10 to the minus 3 eV in axion mass. With, please. Yeah. Well, the standard model doesn't incorporate a solution to the strong CP problem. So the statement is we observe that CP is strongly conserved, and so there is some other solution unknown. I'd be very surprised if the solution didn't have roots in some new chiral symmetry of some kind. But that's my own betting on it. But your statement is correct. If there is no axion, then there's some other solution, as is heretofore unknown. Let me give you a solution which might be it. Maybe quarks have zero mass, or a quark has zero mass. That's some every 2 weeks. Then there's a trivial chiral symmetry. There's a new U1 symmetry, and that's perfectly good U1 symmetry. The problem is it doesn't seem like quarks have zero mass. So you've got a new problem. You've solved the strong CP problem in almost a trivial way, but you now have to somehow get a zero mass quark without having either the current algebra people yell at you or the lattice people yell at you. But I worry about that enough that every 2 weeks I think that's entirely plausible. And that to me is probably of all the solutions, it's probably the most plausible plan B on how to solve the strong CP problem. Either it's a new chiral symmetry or there's a zero mass quark and we're just not clever enough to understand how to encompass it in our ways of doing things. Okay. Anyway, back to Zucchini. He had a great idea. How do you find axions in the window here? Zucchini had this idea. You take a volume of space and you thread it with a huge magnetic field. So here's a solenoidal field that points out. Around that volume of space, you put a high Q cavity, like that. And nearby axion comes in, scatters off the zero energy photon in the magnetic field, and out pops a real photon. Okay? The high Q cavity, the frequency of that cavity set at the frequency of the outgoing photon to enhance this. It's a golden rule problem. The final state density has been increased by Q. What you'd see is something like this. You scan, and in the region of the axion, you'd see a bump. And this is interesting. This is roughly what we would like to see, actually. This would be a threshold axion of the correct virial width. The power levels that we're looking at are really tiny. It's really daunting. To see an axion in realistic hardware, even a very optimistic axion is 10 to the minus 22 watts of power. Okay? We have to integrate for quite a while to see this power. The instantaneous signal to noise is quite poor, so we have to integrate for a while. And for later, let me talk about the scaling laws. It's a signal to noise problem. If the noise got substantially better, the rate that we could scan, the time it takes to do the experiment, improves as the noise temperature squared. So that scaling law is the key, I think, to where we go from here. Let me tell you the two big efforts worldwide. There's a U.S. search, we call it. It's Florida, Fermilab, LBL, Livermore, MIT. It's basically based on what I call conventional, but it's in quotes because it's hardly conventional, amplification. It's got a large volume, high field magnet, and we cool it to about 1.2K with pumped helium cooling. This thing is now a kind of a established experiment. There's published results. It's continuing to operate in their plans. They're now quite solid plans, it turns out, for an upgrade. Okay. There's another experiment in Japan. It's basically the same, except the amplifier is different. Everybody is focusing on the amplifier. They use this thing called Rydberg atom single photon detection. They basically have made a phototube for microwave photons, which is quite impressive. Same principle of the RF cavity, but with a much lower volume. And they have to cool the thing down to dilution refrigerator temperature. They're still commissioning this. And we'll have a picture of this coming up in a minute. This is a picture of the U.S. axion search. Well, maybe I'll go to the next picture. This is a... Here's a picture of the U.S. experiment, of which I'm on, by the way. This is the big cryostat for the experiment. Here's a picture of it, and here's a sketch of it. This is quite a few meters tall from tip to stern. The RF cavity is right down here. This is the RF cavity. It's half a meter in diameter. It's a meter tall, so it's the size of an oil drum. Okay. Big superconducting magnet, 8 Tesla, many tons of windings on it. A really big magnet. We can tune this thing with tuning rods. You move either metal or dielectric rods inside the cavity. You change the shape of the field, and the resonant frequency changes. And we pump it, as I said, to sort of 1.5K noise temperature. And there's a picture of it going into the ground at Livermore. Let me look at the picture on your right. This is the insert that goes into that magnet bore. So this gives you a flavor for the magnet bore. The cavity is actually in here. And this is a vacuum can. This is helium reservoir. The warm temperature flange, the top of the experiment, is right up there. Here's a student who is breaking all of our safety regulations. He's an MIT student. This was a MIT undergraduate. He's now a graduate at Davis. And this is Chris Hogman, who's a postdoc at Livermore. If you take the cover off the top of the cavity, this is what you see. So imagine a big oil drum. You open it up, and you've got this beautiful copper-coated RF cavity. The tuning rods pivot on these points. You can swing them near the center, swing them near the wall. There are metallic ones, and there are ceramic ones, and they have different effects on the resonant frequency of the cavity. I should mention the cues, by the way, are world record cues for these kind of structures. We really know how to plate cavities. This is what the receiver of this experiment looks like. It's basically a radio receiver. A little tiny probe sticks into the cavity, steals some of the power out of the cavity. It goes into some calibration electronics and into one of these state-of-the-art amplifiers. And then it's just amplified, mixed down. It's basically your AM radio here. And it goes into an FFT. So we take a snapshot of the spectral density in the vicinity of the resonant frequency of the cavity. That's basically what we're doing, and we log it. And we actually have two channels. I won't talk about the narrow channel, but we have a channel which is geared towards looking at this Maxwellian of fractional width, 10 to the minus 6, about a gigahertz. That's sort of the resonant frequency here. So this is sort of kilohertz kind of width that we're measuring. I don't want to get into too many details since this is a colloquium and not a seminar, but I'm quite proud of the picture at the bottom left. This is the noise level in one of those receiver bins. It's approaching 10 to the minus 23 watts. So in other words, to read this, if you were at this frequency here, this is the spectral power in that noise power. It's the quietest radio receiver ever made. So it's less than one of these photons per hour. So it's really quite impressive. The axion signal is here. So if you had an axion with this mass, you would have, sorry, if you had an axion of this mass, it would have that much power. So we're really doing quite well. And that's an optimistic axion, I should mention. This is what our data looks like. And on your left is spurious noise, and I won't even tell you how it's spurious. To read this, by the way, explaining all this explains how we take data in our experiment. We don't take a snapshot of the cavity frequency, then make a big step and take another spectrum. We take tiny frequency steps and then take spectra. So these are tiny steps in frequency, and then we add them up. And this is spurious, by the way. And that's one character of things that we see. When we get rid of external noise sources and terminate ports, this signal goes away. Here's a statistical peak. You don't see it in any one spectrum. If you could, we'd only take one spectrum. You add them up, and this would be what a threshold axion candidate looks like. So it looks pretty ratty. On the other hand, so what? It should always be there. So it's easy to rescan when we run into a candidate. And of course, at very, very high confidence, it didn't reappear. It was really a statistical candidate, as near as we can tell. This is what these kind of experiments are doing now. This is axion mass on this axis. And this is the coupling constant of axion and two photon. We scale it with mass to make it flat, to make it the plot a little easier to read. These data have been published already. And for the first time, we're into the model range where you might actually find axions. This is roughly the region here in mass where axions would form dark matter. They could be higher in mass, but they wouldn't give you much density, relic density today. So this is really the region of interest. And I must say, and it wasn't until actually that Harry emphasized this range is quite narrow for very good reasons. This is the model range that you can have, and there are two broad classes of models shown here. It's really quite restricted, factor of 7 or so. And for the first time, these experiments are actually pushing at the plausible model range. And these are some of the earlier experiments. You can see they're many orders of magnitude away. We have data in the can here that's in the publishing cycle. And we're now taking data with the four cavity, and I'll explain what that is, as we speak, into higher mass. So this is really in a production experiment. Let me talk about the Japan search. I'm not going to talk about their RF cavity. I'm not going to talk about their magnet, et cetera, et cetera. Their new thing is their Rydberg amplifier. It's based on the following premise. There's an uncertainty principle between energy and time. And you can turn that into an uncertainty principle in number of quanta and phase. Okay? So pick up Heitler's book, read the introduction. There's a great introduction on why this isn't as crazy as it sounds. And if you don't measure the phase, you can count photons to arbitrary precision. You're no longer bound by this so-called standard quantum limit of noise. Okay? And a phototube does this. If you were to take a garden variety Amperex phototube, and you considered it as a regular quantum limited amplifier, you should have counts at terahertz rate. But in fact, you don't. And why don't you? Because you can't do an interference experiment with the output of a phototube. You've lost the phase information. It's crucial to the operation of a phototube. Unfortunately, it's hard to photoeject electrons with RF photons. You have to be a little more clever. So you use so-called Rydberg atoms. They're mostly alkali atoms. They're in high states of excitation of their principal quantum numbers. They're up to n equal 180, 200 or so. They're really physically rather big. They have large dipole transition rates, okay, so they like to suck in photons. They have long lifetimes, and the spacing between levels, so here's the nth level, the n plus 1 level. Here's a little sketch of the state absorbing a photon, microwave photon. they're in the microwave. So they're good microwave detectors. The trick is, how do you tell that you've detected a microwave photon? And the way you do that is you apply an electric field. Okay, it tilts the spectrum here. So here's the N state. When you're at the N plus 1 state, you can then escape. And believe it or not, you can do this with incredible resolution. Okay. So people have built these things before. They haven't been particularly quiet, but people have built these things. This is the sketch of the Japanese experiment, how they actually implemented this thing. They have two cavities. Here's one cavity, and it's tunable. And here's another cavity that's connected to the first through a port. So these two are electromagnetically connected. They take an ion source, strip it, et cetera, yak, yak, yak. They actually, for perverse reasons, send it through the first cavity. And then, where's the laser? Oh, the laser comes up here, I'm sorry. Then as it goes through, there's a laser, actually three lasers are in this beam, that triply excite this thing up to the Rydberg state. They use diode lasers now, so you can do this fairly easily. So there's this thing, and absorbs a photon, or at least a few of them absorb a photon. And then out it goes, and you selectively ionize those Rydberg atoms that have absorbed a microwave photon. And you can do this with fairly good selectivity, and you then count. Once you have an electron, there are standard counting tricks that you can apply. This experiment has been plagued with problems, and they're still talking about goals of the search. This is how they'd like to, where they'd like to be in their first round. So where we were down here, just kissing this range here, they would like to be anyway, well below this even more pessimistic model. And they're thinking about doing now a real experiment. This is a proof of principle kind of experiment. They really are thinking about doing a real experiment. And we're seeing how well that works. I'm a fellow of the JSPS, this Japanese society, and in principle we're collaborating on these amplifiers. So we're of course thinking if they get their amplifier act together, we have huge cavity tuning everything together. The combination is an absolute natural, so we're working very closely on this. Regardless of if you're doing the Japanese search, you're doing the U.S. search, how do you know it's really an axion? So let's say you're Blas Cabrera, and you've been looking at your monopole data for 3 years, and suddenly a candidate goes by. Well, what do you do? And the answer is you wait another 3 years, or 5 years, or 10 years. That's okay, I guess. What I would do instantly is I would switch modes. So in the lowest mode, where you see an axion, E is in this direction, B, vertical direction, E dot B is non-zero, and the axion should converge. It's a pseudoscalar. We can switch a mode. We have some tuning capability of the TE mode. We can tune until the TE mode, which is the circular E mode, this dual mode, sloshes around like this. E dot B is zero. We better not see a peak. Okay, there should be no conversion. So we tune it to the new place, see what happens. Next, of course, if it survives, we start ramping down the magnetic field, and the axion power should get modulated with B squared. Remember, there's a B in the amplitude and a B squared in the rate. And we have the magnet there to give us this conversion, so we should see it modulated. And very cutely, once we have a real candidate, it's a new experiment. We build two cavities, and we take the coherent sum. You couldn't do this, actually, with a Rydberg atom experiment, but you can do it with our experiment. Take a coherent sum. Why would you do this? You do this because the de Broglie wavelength of these axions isn't microns, and it's not light years. It's units of meters, 100 meters, 10 meters. It's accessible in a laboratory. When these two things are close together, the sum is coherent. As you separate them, they become incoherent on laboratory scales. So you learn something about that. And of course, there's fine structure to the axions falling into our halo. Once we really know we have an axion, we have a beautiful snapshot of the real structure of these axions. coming into our halo. We have really a history of the development of our own halo. Let me talk a little bit about futurism. I'm running out of time. It comes down to money, really. That's what futurism is about. The scanning rate has a B squared V in it and a noise temperature and a Q. We're already at the theoretical maximum for copper, and we can't use superconducting materials because the magnetic field would just play havoc on them. We could go to bigger magnetic field. That costs tons of money. And we focus then on noise temperature of our amplifiers. And here, John Clark and Michael Mook from Giessen have really done incredible work. I'm now telling you about their work here, but it's really exciting. They've applied DC squids to microwave amplification. So very quickly, let me tell you where they're at. This is how well you can do with amplifiers. Okay? This is circa 1990 when we first started to do the R&D of our present experiment. So it's already 2000. It tells you the time constant. So we started thinking about this in 1990, and we actually started writing checks in 1993, but we were thinking about it in 1990. This is frequency, and this is the noise temperature of these amplifiers. Lower noise is better. And you can see lots of technologies at different frequencies. When we started out in 1995, that was our first real shot of data when we got things working. We were at this noise temperature here. We were about 4K when we first started out, and that was publishable data. As of last year, we were down to about 1.3K noise temperature. We have the best amplifiers in the world in this. I must say that the improvement in noise temperature from 4.6K to 1.3 was very difficult. So people say, look, why don't you get it even lower noise? And the answer is, I don't see it. It's extraordinarily hard. And I can't prove it from Maxwell's equations. But I don't see much room for improvement. It's very hard. The idea is to use squids. And the squid is very simple. There's a squid. This is a squid. You take a ring of niobium. You break it in two places with Josephson junctions, and you apply current. The current splits and recombines, and you measure the voltage across the squid. This is essentially two-slit interference, and you can modulate the interference with magnetic flux, threading the loop. So by turning the voltage at the input coil, you can modulate the flux and adjust the two-slit interference pattern that you get. This is the output voltage that you get versus the input voltage. You bias this thing at a certain place, and you can see you have an amplifier. Wiggle this. There are big wiggles there. The beautiful thing is the noise sources are understandable. They're resistive losses in the junctions themselves, and everything follows from that. The prediction is these things should be very, very low noise devices. Haven't been used in the microwave before, and I won't even tell you the trick. There's a huge trick. But this was our first measurement of one of Clark's squids. This is a measurement of the noise temperature of the squid, red on this axis versus frequency. And already this was, a bath temperature was 2K, it was 400 millikelvin. So we knew we were onto something because our best amplifiers are 1.3K. Here we had a 400 millikelvin amplifier. It was really glorious. This is a summary of how we're doing to date. This is Michael Mook, who did a lot of the measurements, a lot of the fabrication of the squids themselves. Basically, at low frequencies, even reasonably high frequencies, we're getting noise temperatures of 100 millikelvin. And these are factors of just a few times the quantum limited noise of these devices. These are very good devices. This is very cute, and I'll just explain it very shortly. We can tune. You do better with an amplifier by having a tuned front end, by making it frequency selective. And the price you pay is you have to rip it out when you go into a new frequency band. One of the tests that we did is hang a varactor, and for theorists who don't know what a varactor is, it's a voltage-dependent capacitor, okay? Called a varactor, it's a trade name, I guess. And here are gain curves for a single squid, but with different varactor voltages. And we can just turn a knob and change the tuning of the squid. It's a glorious development. Okay. Fine. One last thing is we develop piezoelectric motors for this experiment now that work in high magnetic fields and cryogenic temperatures. And the issue is when we eventually go to squids with a dilution refrigerator, we can't have rods and actuators that turn tuning elements, et cetera, from outside. So we developed these piezoelectric motors, and I won't even go into detail. This is the currently operating experiment now. This is now four cavity. Remember, we've gone up in frequency. These are four cavities. Here's these piezoelectric tuning motors. Okay, here's our junction transistor amplifiers. Here's two of them here, and here's a power combiner. That's the experiment that's running now, taking beautiful data. With this experiment, plus our plus adding the dilution fridge, the future of this experiment is this curve here. Okay, so we cover a huge range because of these new amplifiers at a very deep sensitivity here. Why are we doing this, you might ask, at lots of levels? This explains sort of why we're doing it. Kim published a review article, and he took lots of scenarios of beyond standard model axions. And he said, what do I expect for the axion to two-photon coupling constant? And that's basically it here. And you can see here's the pilot experiment. This is our present sensitivity now. This is our sensitivity of the experiment that's running just now. And here's axion mass, 3 microEV. And this is 10 to the minus 5th EV. And what you find is that for these various models, and I can't even explain what these models are, you know, unified versus non-unified. And I don't even know. I just took a whole handful of models. Here's the range of his models. That explains the reason we really want to go here. It encompasses this. And it's no magic. If you want to talk about why the models are clustered, we can talk about it. But this really will be a definitive experiment here. Okay? Let me reach a conclusion. I hope piezoelectric and things didn't cause your brains to crash, but I find them wonderful. There's actually one of the big companies is in Santa Barbara that does R&D of very exotic piezos. They're not exotic technology. They're found in your any mechanical device you have now, CD player, DVD player, anything that's portable is driven by piezoelectric devices now. I mean, that's it. You open them up, and those motors are a dollar. You know. We took a 4-millimeter video recorder apart to get the piezos and the drivers, so we know this stuff. But anyway, let me conclude. These axions address, I think, two mysteries. What is the resolution of the strong CP problem, and what is the nature of dark matter? It's a single beast that says something about both of these. Searching for axions is difficult because these dark matter axions are extraordinarily weakly coupled. Okay, their lifetime, if you had an axion on the table, 10 to the 55th years or something. Very long time, very weak couplings. Yet we've had great success. We're continuing to probe these cold dark matter axion masses and couplings. And I think most importantly, we're finally in the range where these invisible axion models are finally visible at this point. So thanks. Okay. Any questions? Right, I didn't really explain that. It It started relatively slow in the early days of running this experiment in 1995, 1996. We did about a tenth of a decade in mass per year. At the stage we're running now, we have amplifiers which are much, much better. We can do a little worse than half a decade per year within our search region. So that gives you a flavor for it. In practice, what we do is we tune the amp, we tune the cavity to a certain frequency. We integrate. We look at the power in there. We integrate for a few minutes. And then we step in a step that's not epsilon compared to the Q width, but F compared to the Q width. And then we do that again, and we do it again, and we do it again, and we add up those various spectra into a grand canonical power spectrum. Actually, you're absolutely right. The noise floor has, what does it have in it? It has integration time, bandwidth, and noise. Improve any of those? The bandwidth, we're stuck because the axion is the axion. Integration time you could improve. Unfortunately, there's square roots floating around. Noise comes in directly, which is why we focus on noise time. Please. It's a very interesting question. In the present experiment, we can go up with our four... Well, let me put that up. We have hardware in place. We have hardware in place to scan to about here, okay? And you read down, and it's order, you know, 10 microev, EV-ish, 11 microev, 11 EV. At that point, you run into what we call the Swiss watch problem. You break the volume into so many small cavities, I think it's impossible to do an experiment. At that point, we go into a different cavity structure, and I wish, in fact, I may have a picture of this for you. The trick is we need a new idea there, and with any luck, let's see if I've got it at hand. If I don't have it at hand, no, I don't. With any luck, okay, the bottom line is we have to go to different electromagnetic structures which are geometrically large but have high frequency. And we do that, our idea anyway, is to put posts in. So we're making a photonic band gap cavity would be the lingo for the condensed matter people. But really what it is, it's a loaded cavity structure which maintains the TM, the equivalent of the TM mode is still up and down, and it resonates at a higher frequency. I wish I had a picture. We have beautiful models of this, but, oh, here it is. You can sort of get the flavor of the structures that we make. This is a slice through the mid-plane. This is the electric field magnitude in a slice through the mid-plane of this oil can, okay? And here are metallic posts, and of course you would force a zero where you have the metallic posts here. And here you have, I don't know how many posts, 15, 20, 30. It depends on the model that we ran. But the point is, this thing here has a frequency which is a factor of 3 over the naked frequency of this thing. And you get higher frequencies, of course, the more posts you have. There's a new scale, basically, in this thing. So our idea, and we haven't firmed this up, how do we go beyond 10 microEV? We'll use this kind of structure is the way we think we're going to go. And we, you can see we're already doing R&D on it. We have a test structure. Seems to be okay. The issue of tuning comes into place here. So the idea of tuning it is we're actually going to gang tune these rods. And I don't even want to... It doesn't work yet, so I don't really have it yet, but we're thinking about how to make it work. The other thing is you need amplifiers that go beyond 10 gigahertz, go to 10 to 100 gigahertz, and we're working on that too. So the bottom line is we're clearly we understand how to go to the first decade, how to cover the first decade of that window. It's an important decade because for misalignment production of axions, that's the place to look. If you believe in defects in axion strings as the thing which make axions, we have to go to the second decade. For that, we need new RF structures and we need better cavities. We need better amplifiers, and actually that's in the works, but hasn't gelled yet. Oh, please. Hi.
I just wanted to get a feeling for what the operational experience was for the first round. You showed some of the things of what your data looked like. You had some other spurious things. Can you tell us what those were and what
sure. Right, one of those, sure. Let me put up one plot, which is kind of interesting. And this is an interesting plot here. This is 100 megahertz of our data. And this is the deviation about the thermal mean and standard deviation, the distribution of the deviation. It looks Gaussian, it's not. This line is Nyquist noise, thermal noise input at the front end of our chain. So it's not Gaussian at the back end of the chain, but it mimics, so we understand our data at least in the mean sense of our data. We have a few which are non-statistical. Okay, and among those which are non-statistical, I should mention, by the way, our candidate threshold is here. These are all our candidates. We set our threshold low because we don't pay much of a penalty to rescan anything that makes us suspicious. And that was the Cabrera argument. You know, we don't have to wait 3 years. We've got a candidate, we'll sit and we'll look and see with high confidence if it's a candidate or not. And we have two kinds of things to get us, as I said. This showed up. What we see mainly is we see a little peak in the power spectrum. This is the power spectrum. And we see a peak. And it was a significant peak. It was, you know, 5, 6, 7 standard deviations. It was really quite a peak. Couple things to notice about it. It didn't look like a peak even in first examination. It didn't look like a candidate, a good one. It developed off resonance. This is a balanced amplifier. I won't go into details, but you don't see the resonance peak here. But in fact, it's buried in there. You just don't see it. This thing should have developed here, not at the edge where the Q is small. Okay? The other thing that happened with this is we went back and we terminated our calibration ports. And that turned out to be where this one was sneaking in. When we retook the data and focused on that, it disappeared. We then take the termination off, effectively, of our calibration, it reappears. The other thing is, Livermore has really odd background. There exists an example, well, you laugh, but they have an 800.00012 decimal places, as we can tell. We have a clock that for those kind of frequencies is extraordinarily accurate. It's good to 12 decimal places. We see a deviation of this Livermore ambient signal only at the one part in the 13th, and it's probably our clock, because our clock isn't that good. So you could use this, instead of buying a $50,000 clock, you could just hang out at Livermore and pick up their signal there. It's so monochromatic and so good. And we don't know what that is, but somebody spent a lot of money to make a beautiful 800.0000 something signal at Livermore. We're looking at this is a very tiny piece. Each one of these is about a minute of data. Here's another minute. It gives you a flavor for how we add up our data. That was a year's worth of data from 1996 or 1997. That was 100 megahertz of data. So it was quite a bit of data. It was a year of data. Well, we only have noise. Right, absolutely. Yes.
If I could do somehow a broadband measurement, would I have the same signal to noise for the same integration time?
No. No. The Q comes into this. To make it broadband, I'd have to lower. It's subtle. I'll explain what the cavity does. The cavity makes the search narrow band. It's a resonant system. If you make Q higher, you make the system narrower, the conversion rate goes up. Q appears, and the conversion rate goes up. You don't cover as many bins simultaneously. So something gets worse. You win slowly. You win a square root of Q. Okay? Until you become so narrow that you start to pinch off your signal. So as long as you encompass a reasonable fraction of your anticipated signal, make the Q bigger. Great. But as soon as you start pinching it, you don't win anymore. Okay, and broadening it really reduces the rate that you can scan at a fixed frequency, and there's a square root of Q floating around. Mm.